What up, everyone? Welcome to the Smoking Tire Podcast. This episode is brought to you by Auto Tempest. Look, if you are looking for a car, whether you're trying to buy it or sell it, you need to know the market. And the best place to get the gauge of the whole market is AutoTempest.com. Why? Because all you have to do is put your search terms in one time, and Auto Tempest searches the entire internet. Cars.com, CarSoup, Cars Direct, not to mention Auto Trader, Craigslist, eBay, and Facebook Marketplace. Auto Tempest, and Bring a Trailer. Now that I mentioned it, Bring a Trailer as well. Auto Tempest searches all of it, you guys. Typing in search terms over and over is a thing of the past. AutoTempest.com is here for you. They've been with us forever. We appreciate them, and they fund a bunch of other cool content around the YouTube space. So use AutoTempest.com when you're searching for your next new car. We're also brought to you by Dylan Optics Sunglasses. You know those awesome sunglasses that I am wearing in every video? Sometimes it's like plastic frames, sometimes it's more aviator style, sometimes it's like the wraparounds, always with the matte finish lenses. That's Dylan Optics Sunglasses, guys. The NIR lens technology means that your eyes are protected from harmful UV rays. They're polarized. It makes it really, really easy to see, even after a long day in the sun. They're easy to clean, and they last a long time. They're pretty tough. I beat mine up pretty bad. That's not to say I haven't damaged them. I have, but I treat mine pretty badly, and they take a beating, and they're really, really good glasses. So if you go to our website, thesmokingtire.com, you click on that Partners tab, and there's Dylan Optics. If you use that link, we will send you a free t-shirt, Smoking Tire t-shirt, for every frame you purchase at thesmokingtire.com under the Partners tab. Dylan Optics Sunglasses. All right, folks, this episode should be pretty cool. Really interesting conversation with a really interesting guy. Kevin Zinger is an entrepreneur. He is an automaker. He's a technology guy. He kind of does a little of everything, but his car is basically 3D printed, which is really, really cool. So we're talking about that, but we're also talking about the total environmental cost of cars. It's a really, really interesting conversation. I don't want to get too far into the intro. Just get into the conversation. Kevin Zinger of Zinger Automotive.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Smoking Tire Podcast. Start of a new week. We're stacking them deep because we got the Zoom thing going on, and well, fairly open schedules. And also, you know, within a couple of weeks, Zach and I are going to be moving to the new studio. And so there may be a couple of weeks where we don't have a functional studio. And so by getting ahead a little bit, we're gonna handle that situation logistically a little better. So the content river keeps on flowing even while we are loading gear into U-Hauls and moving across the street. That being said, welcome to the show today. We have a special guest, Mr. Kevin Zinger of Zinger. And just like he told me earlier, like Czar, like the hey, Czar everybody. Of Russia, CZ is pronounced Z. Welcome, sir.
Thanks. Hey, Matt. Hey, Smoking Tires people out there.
How's it how's it going on your half of Los Angeles?
Well, I mean, it's a very nice evening turning into twilight, and it's beautiful around my home. It's a pretty typical work day. I'd say on the engineering side that we're having very productive days through our VPN network, and the factory is less productive because we have a small crew there. We're mainly doing to support the local medical community, and also in Texas where we're manufacturing PPE equipment, you know, face shields and masks related PPE equipment using our plastic 3D printing equipment. So there's a skeleton crew there, but that's how it's going.
So you got a couple of companies going on, and they're intertwined. I learned about Divergent, which is the 3D printing company, a couple of years ago. I had some conversations with one of your people about trying to drive something called the Blade, which I yes. would still love to drive if it still exists somewhere. And then now we've got the Zinger car, which is a different thing, a new thing. So tell me how all this works, Kevin.
Well, the way that it all works is that, you know, having co-founded a car company and co-founded an EV battery company, and having grown up in Cleveland with two older brothers as car mechanics, most of my life has been fixated on cars and building cars and thinking about cars. And you know, one thing you very quickly learn is that when you're going to design a car and build a car, you know, the biggest issue is turning those ideas and that engineering know-how into an actual physical structure that is the car, right?
Yeah, harder than it looks, as they say.
Yes. So, you know, you look, for example, you know, you go to build, you know, an EV, and you're even converting a car into an EV that's an existing internal combustion engine car.
Mm-hmm.
When I was running an EV company, I ended up spending more on just retooling the body to convert it to an EV from an internal combustion engine car, like about $200 million. And that's over in China, where it is as cheap as it can be. More on that than I spent on building, first designing really the first prismatic automotive grade battery cell module pack thermal management battery management system, and then a million square foot mega factory, which opened in 2010 in Tianjin. I spent more money on retooling that car than all of that technology development. And I looked at it and said, this is what is broken in this industry. This is what is actually truly broken.
Is when you say this, do you mean literally the trying to re-engineer existing models for EV? Do you mean the slowness of that process, or do you mean the lack of 3D printing? What specifically?
I mean taking an idea, a design, engineering that, then having to go through a process of tooling, meaning you have to design and build a tool.
Right.
Then you have to either stamp or cast something, and then you finally have a something. And that's over a very long cycle. You know, the shortest for a smaller component is probably 6 months or so. You know, the longest to tool up a car is 12 months or so. And then if you go to iterate that, then you're throwing away millions of dollars of tools and remachining a tool to stamp or recast something. So your ideas are always needing to be frozen in some very expensive, basically cookie cutter that allows you to manufacture that part, right?
Right.
And it's the exact opposite of digital flexibility, right? We sit down and we used to have these things called printing presses, and these printing presses used to have type. I mean, the auto manufacturing is like having a huge expensive printing press that can only print one book. It's like has the type welded to it, right?
Yeah.
And that's the exact opposite of flexible, creative, and innovative, right? So you look and you go, okay, how in a digital world where I now have high performance computing and AI and new materials and potentially additive manufacturing, 3D printing, and new ways to assemble, why haven't we used any of those tools? Why haven't we combined those into the industrial version of Mac desktop publishing, where you move away from that big printing press machine, and you move to something that doesn't care whether it's printing a Bible or a comic book or War and Peace, right?
You've
got the same software and hardware, you send some data in, something, mm-hmm. you know, the data, you know, reflects the output, doesn't change the machine at all.
Oh, that was what I was going to ask. I was going to ask if, you know, obviously a 3D printer could print anything, but do you use a variety of somewhat specialized 3D printers?
Well,
is it literally, you could use one printer and make a whole car with enough software?
Here's what I would say, which is the issue with 3D printing metals, alloys, is the commercially available printers are way too slow, and the commercially available materials do not allow you to print components, say suspension structures or the actual chassis safety performance structure of the vehicle, those materials don't allow you to print those structures so that they'll actually meet performance requirements. So they'll actually have the strength and durability, or say in the crash area of the vehicle, have the ductility, have the ability to absorb energy. None of that exists.
Right. So you could print a concept car.
Here's what I will say. None of it existed until we invented a whole series of things in 400 plus patent filings now over the last 5 years. So we actually do have the Mac, industrialized Mac desktop publishing system. But it's our patented materials, a machine that we did the specification for, which all of these things are interdependent. You need a machine that is able to print the materials that you want to generate at a certain cost point. And those materials in turn need to say when they're using laser melting to create the material layers, they have to have the right morphology and the right makeup so that they can absorb energy and have the right part density. So all of these things, many, many, many thousands of things, are interrelated. And what hadn't happened prior to our doing, as far as I know, and I know a bit, none of that was done as an integrated system. Everyone was looking and saying, oh, 3D printing, yes, we can use any material and we can do anything. And when you try to do everything, you can't really do anything well. You have to purpose build and architect a system, right? And that's what we did. And then in the end, when you do that, and the system has to have an economic purpose, it has to be able to have materials that, so for example, here, I'll give you one example and then I'll shut up for a bit, which is,
that's okay, I'm interested. You can go on for an hour and a half if you like. I'm interested in this is cool.
My wife's always complaining I'm going on too long, so Matt, not that I want to put you in a position.
The audience is tired of hearing me anyway.
Please step in whenever you want. But hey, so one thing is, you look and say, hey, I need a printable material that has enough ductility so that in a crash it's going to absorb energy. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be brittle and crumble, right? Which is what the standard materials that are available for, say, aluminum structures with 3D printing. That's what the standard structures will do. They'll just crumble, right? So you look and you go, okay, what's available? And say you look to the aerospace industry, and for example, Airbus has a material that's called scalmalloy, but it has scandium in it, which is a super expensive material, right? So you look and go, oh, that's great, but it's completely unaffordable to do anything for mass production. So what do we have to do? We have to have a material.
Scandium? That's awesome.
Scalmalloy.
Yeah, it's called scalmalloy from Airbus, but it's $300 plus a kilogram for the overall material. It's as an alloy, you don't want to print with something like that if you're doing mass production, right? But if you're looking at cars, you go, hey, I want to do something that is going to have the right ductility and still be printable. And so you need to bring in a team of PhD material scientists and do a whole huge amount of materials development, printing on a machine that's designed to print that type of material, testing of that material, refining of it, and do that materials development for automotive. And that allows you to take something that has scandium in it to something that doesn't have any expensive element in it and outperforms that alloy, that scalmalloy, in terms of ductility. And the price is, say, under $20 a kilogram instead of over $300 a kilogram.
Oh, wow.
And that's when you have something that's usable. But you can't do that unless you are looking at a problem from a system level, meaning as an economic and technology problem that are interwoven. And then you're designing a system that meets both the economic requirements and those performance requirements and the volume scalability requirements. And in the case of automotive, obviously the quality requirements.
Yeah, well, it also depends, I guess, what kind of car you want to build. I mean, if you want to you know, if you want to build a $2 million car, I suppose you have a little more flexibility than if you're trying to build a $50,000 car, right?
Absolutely. And you'll use, say, in the 21C car that we have, you know, we're using Inconel, we're using titanium, we're using a number of exotic, expensive materials that we print with. But yeah. my idea, and it's just going back because you had asked me about the origin of what this all is. I mean, the origin of it is, how do you really, if you look at this world, you know, in a world where, you know, in order to build a car company, look, you know, Tesla's spent 20 billion plus to what, you know, manufacture 400,000 vehicles last year. It is enormously expensive to try to create a new car company, right?
Yes.
I mean, $20 billion to manufacture 400,000 vehicles is a lot of money, right?
It is if you say it is. I haven't done the math on it, but I mean, I know if you just think about $20 billion in general, it's a lot of money. Right. But I mean, I don't know. Do they?
So
it is if you're not making any back.
Either you need huge government subsidies, you know,
or you've hit the nail on the head.
Whether you're Hyundai, Kia, Toyota, either you've existed for a long time so that you already have, you know, some bank credit so that you have, you know, access to capital.
Yeah.
You know, or you need some massive subsidy to get started. Right.
Right.
And by the way, you know, obviously Elon Musk is a brilliant marketing guy and created a new brand. Right. But they also accessed an enormous amount of capital. And, you know, that's why the company survived and now prospers. But I looked at that and said, well, you know what, Kevin, think like a hot rodder, right? I mean, who do you really want to build, you know, why do you want to build a Mac desktop publishing machine? You want to build it so that not only can small teams create something as cool as the 21C, but they could also build all kinds of different cars. And that meant that fundamentally you needed to have a base set of alloys that could create affordable things,
mm-hmm.
as well as extraordinary things with, you know, expensive exotic materials like the 21C.
Yeah, well, I can see the marketing side of it where if you want to make a splash, you start, you know, you build something crazy and then work your way down. If you brought out a hatchback, I think that would actually be a harder uphill battle.
Sure. I think, and even beyond that, I think what you really want to do when you're testing materials and you're creating things, you want to have something that's really the ultimate expression of human imagination, right?
For sure.
And show that the technology can do it. So here, imagine this, and obviously, you know, you're welcome to come again, visit us anytime and see this in action.
I would like to. I haven't. Zach went with part of another job. Zach has two jobs. We all have several jobs. And he came to visit you guys as part of a television shoot he was working on. I wasn't part of that. I'd love to come check it out. I know you're not far away from us.
Sure.
It certainly seems very interesting. I mean, I love the idea of using additive manufacturing to make shapes that you can't make. Any other way, really, or any other reasonable kind of way. I'm like a watch nerd, and we're starting to see that with watch parts as well. Although they certainly don't have the, you know, they don't crash test
right,
watches.
Strength requirements,
but yeah, they don't crash test watches, but it's still a very interesting thing because we're looking at, looks like a suspension component of some kind, some fucking alien thing on the screen right now. But it's a really cool idea. The question that I have for you is, do you want to be a car builder? Do you want to be an inventor? Do you want to be someone who licenses a technology licensor? What is your goal with all this? Because you got so many things going on.
Well, we really have two things going on, right? What one is... You're creating, you're thinking, how do you really unleash human imagination? For example, high performance computing now, look at the video games that it allows you to create.
Yeah.
Right? The small team create. But that's, you know, that's on a screen or on VR. How do you use that, you know, generative design, AI, high performance computing connected to additive manufacturing, or you want to call it 3D printing. Obviously, there are a range of different technologies. How do you connect those together to unleash human creativity, right? And when you're looking at that, in order to do it, you actually have to create a system and start to build things. So that industrialized Mac desktop publishing system I'm talking about, you then have to make things. And when you make things, you want to make things that express the ultimate in your thinking and what you can make. And so these things are actually completely intertwined, these two different things. The divergent technology that we have over 400 patents filed, the foundational patents all issued around, you know, everything from the system level patent to all of the gating technology patents across, completely new novel materials, machines, machine hardware and software, multi-material structures, optics and software relating to automation and robotics. All of those things are combined into one system and all have their own set of patents. And probably for the first, you know, tens of patents, I was a lead inventor. So, I know what that's about now that we're, moving forward. Obviously, I have a bunch of tech domain experts that are solving problems, generating IP, generating patents. But the idea is, if you're creating the machine and you own that machine, then you want to create the coolest stuff and present that to the world. And what you want to do is say, hey, look, this is really cool stuff that's getting created. You can do it too. License it. Here are the enormous economic and creative and environmental advantages of licensing and using this technology to create vehicles. And here's like a crazy off the hook example of the tool creators using these tools to create the most off the hook stuff that they can and brand it and sell it.
Do you see, I imagine you must see opportunity in the fact that you could basically build a car factory anywhere, right?
Yes,
like you, you could build a car factory in like sub-Saharan Africa and like six dudes could build cars there, right?
I wouldn't say six. Here's an idea, Matt.
Yeah.
Could within the next 10 years, would it be totally possible that you had in every major mega city in Africa, maybe 20, 30, 40 modular factories that are non-design specific? So, you know, imagine you have a GUI, a database, a material set, a printer farm and an assembly farm, because these vehicle structures are automatically assembled, right?
Are they?
They have the assembly features designed in them. So literally, a 20 by 20 square foot vertical cell, 20 by 20 square vertical cell will assemble 10,000 vehicles a year. Vehicle structures, do the body assembly up, right?
Wow.
You could have that industrialized Mac desktop publishing system in all of those places. They could do localized manufacturing for their area, and the hardware and the software would never change, whether they were doing a two-seat EV or an SUV or a pickup truck.
So when you said a minute ago that the assembly is built into the printing program, do you literally mean
into the part?
So like it's like it comes out, it goes on, it comes out, it goes on, it comes out, it goes on. And like, is a human involved in that process at all?
Imagine, and I'm super simplifying.
Yeah.
Because there are a bunch of process steps, but imagine you generate data.
Mm-hmm.
That data has all of your load cases looped in it. So you take all the physics models, whether it's, crash or thermal or durability, like a ENCODE for durability, or LS-DYNA or EDIOS for crash. And it's looped in all of your physics models. It's optimized the structure, so it's taking a material that's designed for a purpose, only putting it where it's needed.
Yeah.
So it's as light a structure, as efficient a structure as possibly can be made for a set of requirements. Sends that to a printer. The printer prints it. It comes out of that printer. It gets put on, an AGV, a mobile parts table, uh-huh. robotic mobile parts table. That parts table moves to a cell, and the cell itself is being told with a message, you're about to assemble subframe XYZ. Here is the assembly sequence of it. And here is the tool path that all of the robots need to follow. And we're not using conventional robotic technology either for doing this, but imagine then that the various parts and pieces have features that allow them to come together like, customized Lego pieces.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty awesome. That's pretty cool. I am definitely on board with this. This sounds like a lot.
Hey, come check it out. This sounds
like literally endless possibilities. I'm a fan of this. Let's talk about the 21C, the car.
Sure.
Okay, so now that you kind of understand the ethos and how this stuff is made, you have made this crazy looking car. How? Because I remember seeing the blade. I think Jaga is the 21C related at all to the blade? They had a similar look.
Well, the blade is sort of if you go back, the Porsches that you see today, there was actually an aero car from like the 1930s that Ferdinand Porsche built, right?
Yeah, I remember.
And it was sort of the first very raw prototype.
Yeah.
Well, the 21C, I'd say, is like iterated version 100 of what that is.
Okay. Can you remind me, divergent blade?
Massively changed.
The blade.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you go from blade to 21C? I just want to see the styling changes to see if I could, what the difference is.
So that's the blade, and let me.
And that's 21C there.
That's
okay,
kind of
yeah.
Rough shot.
The 21C is like every single piece of it is designed to fit with every single other piece of it. It's a much wider, longer vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
That has a powertrain we designed and built ourselves, and basically that is what can happen when every piece of the vehicle can be imagined and put together. So, you achieve, the holy grail of engineering and design, which is the sum of the parts is greater than the individual parts themselves. And that's what it is.
It seems like the blade was the first kind of idea, and you're like, okay, let's have the cockpit in driver and passenger in line, and then you can have this shape because of that layout. But then the 21 is just the next, like a big step forward, because you made it. When did you start designing the 21 versus the blade? Like, how many years between the two?
I mean, there were a couple of years and a lot of technology development, right?
So, yeah.
I was the blade I did when I was first inventing, and I built a single vehicle, right? And I was myself the only employee. So that's Kevin Zinger coming out of the garage in 2015, and the blade is 2020, many, 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 many iterations forward.
So the 21C.
One's like a stick figure, and the other is, total badass technology.
So you've got driver and passenger in line. You've got, it's electric. Give me some stats on this thing.
No, it's a hybrid. It's a strong hybrid.
Oh, it's hybrid. Oh, okay. Excuse me. My bad. Give me some stats.
So, it has two electric motors, one for each wheel up front. and there's no drive shaft, and there's a mid-engine internal combustion engine, you know, that puts out about 950 horsepower. You know, it depends on what boost you have. You know, relatively modest boost, you're going to put out, you know, 930 to 950 horsepower at about 10,500 RPM. It's got a red line at around 11,000. It's a 2.88 liter V8 that we designed. As I said, it has two turbochargers. You know, we designed all of the pieces around it, the thermal management of it. Yeah, and there you go. So you put those together, and you
know, 1,250 horsepower at 10,000
vehicle with, wow, you know, 2,600 pound dry weight. You know, coming out of a corner, obviously that's when, or accelerating a car, that's when you want the front wheel drive.
Yeah, no kidding.
Because you need more tire surface area, right, at the lower speed to accelerate. I mean, you can't, you know, there's no tires out there where you can really, you know,
1,200? No, there aren't.
No, I was just saying, even for the 930 horsepower, you know, mid-engine, for the rear wheels, you know, they run the, you know, the mid-engine internal combustion engine drives the rear wheels through a seven-speed sequential gearbox, also that we designed.
You guys so
that,
made
that
your
drives
own
the
gearbox?
Rear wheels, and then the front wheels, when it's needed for acceleration, those are electric, and we have, you know, torque vectoring of the front wheels. So this is, you know, torque vectoring, all-wheel drive when you need it, coming out of corners, accelerating, you know, 0 to 100 kilometers an hour in under 2 second, 8 second quarter mile ET car. You know, this is
yikes. And you know, so there, and so is, you is, you guys designed like you the seven speed sequential gearbox.
Sorry, pardon, I didn't hear what you said.
You said you designed the gearbox in house as well?
Yeah, we designed. I mean, we didn't manufacture the gearbox itself. It was manufactured by Hewlin for us.
Oh, it's Hewlin. Yeah, so it's a proper sequential.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Does it use a clutch pedal?
Clutchless gearbox, clutchless seven speed.
Is it a dual clutch?
So we did a design and a set of requirements, uh-huh, and Hewlin built it for us.
Oh, so it's, yeah, basically like Hewlin basically builds race gearboxes. So that's pretty much.
Sure.
Is it?
So there are two versions. Yeah. One for the track vehicle doesn't, you know, it's just has dog ears in it.
Uh huh.
It's loud, but you know, I don't care. I like raw cars, right? I like raw. You know, I build cars, and I just love them stripped down, and I don't care if they're loud. And the track car, the track version of the car, the track kit has a gearbox that just has the dog ears, no synchros, and then there's a road version, a street version that has synchros in the gearbox. But both manufactured by Hewlett.
What are some of the other differences between the track car and the street car?
You know, different aero. Obviously, you need a lot of downforce. There's, a rear wing, dive planes on the vehicle. Uh-huh. Just the front and rear splitter are different. There's a rear seat delete and some other lightweighting to the vehicle.
Now, let me ask you about this twin turbo V8. From 2.88 liters to get 950 horsepower is extremely intense. And obviously, you need the revs to get there. A more modest rev that a more modest manufacturer might consider their red line, call it 7,000. Does it make similar power to the... to like a high performance germ, like the 4 liters that they're using in the AMG cars and stuff like that? Is it like in the sixes at around seven, and you just make that rest of that power just through pure revs?
You know, I'd say the torque and the power curve are pretty flat toward the top, but you know, I was looking for a car that had the sound and excitement of an early 2000s Formula One car. You know, back when they had the cars that could rev, you know, well into the teens, and, you know, have it so that it would be durable enough for the road and to hold up for somebody who's, you know, not a professional driver. you know, on the track who wanted to have a road track car. And obviously, if they want to have it professionally driven, it can be driven, you know, very, very fast, you know, a, you know, track record beating production car.
Yeah.
But, you know, you know, you only have one life to live. Matt.
Yeah, no, look, I'm not criticizing.
Sound.
I'm not criticizing you. I'm just wondering.
Those four of them. And you know what? I don't have to build this car to any regulations. I don't have to follow somebody's, you know, aero rules or any of the rules, you know, any of these different FIA rules. So you look at this and go, you know what? If you're going to be a total rule breaker and you want to do something cool, look at every single piece of it. And even if it's a marginal gain, add the marginal gain and make it where you put all of those together and you have the ultimate cool car.
Speaking of rule, you know, you say rules and I understand your implication was rules for a racing series, if I understood you correctly.
Yeah.
What about rules for the road?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, this is set up to be fully homologated first in North America, in the U.S. and Canada, and then in the EU.
Uh huh.
You know, they're basically the same homologation rules.
Okay. And what I haven't seen a 21C in person, and in the pictures that you have that Zach's kind of scrolling through here, they're sort of studio shots. Can you give me a sense of the size of the car, like compared to another sports car that I might be more familiar with?
It's probably similar to a Corvette, but wider.
Okay.
Similar to the new mid-engine Corvette, but wider.
So even though you're sitting driver and passenger in a straight line, the car itself does not get much narrower because of that, or at least the track width doesn't.
No, I mean, the cockpit, you know, there's a cockpit which cuts down on, you know, the frontal surface area around the driver and passenger, although there's actually a lot of room within the cockpit part of the car. But, you know, if you're a driver and you love to drive, or you're a go-kart, you know, you love go-karts, you love sort of down low, high speed vehicles, right?
Yeah.
The most exciting position to be in. I mean, the driver position for a driver car, the ultimate position is to be in the center of the car.
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course.
And so then the question is, okay, you know, do you want to have a passenger or not? You know, I mean, the old...
No, yes, you do. You definitely want to have a passenger.
F1 was great with two passengers in the back, but I never got it because I would never think of driving something like this with more than one person, you know, with me going and doing something. And so I looked at that and said, you know, minimize that frontal surface area, have the cockpit, have the driver sit in the middle. It's an ultimate driver's car. You know, and then in terms of the track, I mean, this is meant to be driven really fast, you know, into curvy, high downforce tracks like Willow Springs and like Laguna Seca.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so there, downforce to lift. I mean, it's much more important even than horsepower to have that downforce.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the wider the track, you know, the better the airflow and aerodynamics and downforce that you're going to get, right? Because, you know, you have that air trapped under the vehicle, you know, you have the air washing out of the wheel wells. You need to be able to channel all of that and have, you know, a wider vehicle. You want to get more tire to the ground, especially if you're looking and going, you know what? I don't have to follow anybody's rules. This is like Can-Am from the 60s and early 70s, which was, that was always my favorite, you know, favorite racing series, like the no rules, ultimate, go for it totally, McLaren's, you know, Jim Hall, Chaparral's.
Psycho death machines.
Porsche 917s, Donahue's car, all of that, like, totally go for it. And this is like totally go for it. Look at everything you can do, put it into one car and make it into like ultimate American driving machine.
Is it possible? So, you know, you've got this hybrid system. I'm not making any assumptions anymore. Does it use batteries or does it use something else that's not batteries?
Sure. So because we're only using the front wheels to accelerate and in corners, we have two relatively small battery packs, each of which is only a couple kilowatt hours.
Uh-huh.
That drive each of the front motors. Those in turn, you know, there are two things. One, you know, you have regenerative braking, so you know you're really just using the motors as a brake to, you know, turn into a generator and then put power back into the battery pack.
Yeah, with 950 horsepower engine, you probably barely have to touch the brakes in normal driving, right? You can probably just basically engine brake. Can you 1 foot drive it? Will it brake hard enough if you 1 foot, if you just lift?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how you set the regenerative braking, but yeah. And then the second thing is there's a rear generator that is tied to the crank of the rear of the mid engine internal combustion engine,
uh-huh.
And that generator recharges the front batteries.
Okay.
Well,
that was my question. So if you went out and did a half hour track day, it will generate enough juice that you're not going to exhaust the hybrid powertrain during a standard lapping session.
Exactly. So here's the thing: between the regenerative braking and having that rear generator on the internal combustion engine, you, unlike an electric car where each lap you're losing a bunch of power, right?
Yeah.
And obviously generating massive heat. This is, you know, basically allowing you to have your full power for the entire set of track laps, because you're using that rear generator.
Yeah.
You know, to always make sure that you know, you've
got
full power
into
those front electric motors.
That's
the cool thing.
Yeah.
I mean, in that strong hybrid setup, you get the benefit of the front wheels being driven and you know, with torque vectoring plus driving the front wheels, you get that additional power pulling you out of the corner or accelerating you for 0 to 100 kilometers or, you know, for a quarter mile or 0 to 400 to kilometers an hour to zero.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you can keep it like super light by just having little battery packs that you use a rear generator to recharge along with generative braking.
Can it drive
on? That allows you to have a lighter car that gives you all of the benefits of you know, all-wheel drive.
Can it drive on EV only?
Yeah, a little bit, but that's, you know, that's not the purpose. And then
no, I was just curious.
Thing,
you know,
the other
so
thing
there's
that
people,
I
there
do,
might be some folks in Kensington who care about the London tax. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
you throw 10 miles of EV in there, it saves them like $100,000 or whatever. You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is supposed to be the ultimate car. So, you know, as they say, if you have to worry about
listen,
the upkeep of a yacht,
people who can afford the ultimate cars
in the yacht market. But, you know, they remember that song that says, hey, you can't please everyone, so you've got to please yourself. Well,
I'm just saying, man, there's people who have 7-figure cars and register them shits in Montana. So I don't want to hear the, if you can afford it, then blah, blah, blah. There's the richer you are, the cheaper you are. And if you could sell someone a car that's $2 million, but you don't have to pay taxes on it in London, there is a market for that. I'm just saying.
You may be right, Matt. You may be right. So,
look up how many Paganis are registered in the state of Montana. It's like 12, and they have maybe like 2 million people in the whole state. It's a little silly.
It's very easy to register there. That's
yes,
one thing.
It is.
They make it easy. They make it easy, and gives them some income for sure.
What is, I mean, I know there's nothing like it, but what are some of the sensations like when driving something like the 21C in anger?
Well, you know, imagine you're like a jet fighter pilot on a track.
Yeah.
Without wings, right? You just
yeah. So it's Forza in real life. It's like crazy racing simulator speeds, but in real life is what you're talking about. Basically.
Yeah. And hey, you know, I mean, look, I'm dating myself, but. You know, you look at things like, you know, the inspiration for this, you know, Top Gun, right? Or, you know, super bikes. I mean, being there, you know, not only being in the cockpit of a fighter, right, with a co-pilot, but being on a super bike with somebody on the back.
Right? I've been on the back of a superbike with a MotoGP rider. It scared the shit out of me, I got to be honest.
That's what's cool.
Yeah, no, for sure. I look, this is a special thing. I've driven all the newest, fastest, crazy stuff, and frankly, the fact that a lot of what's available, it just takes like money to get it, and you know, you get out of something like a McLaren 720S or a Taycan Turbo S Porsche or the new 4GT or a Koenigsegg, and you go, or even a Hellcat, you know what I mean? Even a Challenger Hellcat, and you go, Jesus, it's just money. All you need to do is write a check and you can have this like missile, you know, and the kind of stats that you're talking about, 8 seconds in the quarter, 1,250 horsepower, 2,600 pounds. I mean, I drove a Hennessy Venom GT, and say what you want to say about John Hennessy, that fucking thing was real. And I did 0 to 200 in 16 seconds with a hoodie on without even trying. And I was like, okay, I now know what the fear is. And we now know what the end point is of tuner cars. And I'm just like, I'm actually scared of where this thing is going to go.
You know, you need to be. I mean, you need to know how to drive if you really want to push it, right? But
I think I'm okay at that. I think I'm all right at driving. Are these publicity photos real?
To have fun, you need. I mean, to really drive it as a performance car, you need to go to a track. I mean, take it to a track and.
Not even a track. You got to go to a big track.
You need to get to know the car on the track and.
Like, if you took this thing to thermal...
That devil keeps tapping you on your shoulder until you go faster and faster and faster, and then...
Yeah, and then you sail it off a cliff.
Hopefully you just run it into the infield or something, and you get back on, right?
Look, it looks nuts. I mean, it's not even you need a racetrack. You need a big racetrack. You need, like, Road America or something, you know, because there's a lot of these private racetracks. Like, Thermal is not that big. Spring Mountain is a lovely place, but it's tight. There's nowhere to run a 1,200 horsepower car at Thermal.
No, you need an F1 approved type track. Yeah. And it's like basically for any hyper car.
I mean,
like
you've got a lot of downforce with this car and really good aero. I mean, this.
You wouldn't get out of second gear in that car.
This is a downforce. You know, if you were looking, say, you know, I mean, in LMP1, people talk about. You know, downforce tracks and horsepower tracks. I mean,
we're on the same page here, buddy.
I love California.
You need a big track.
I grew up reading Hot Rod magazine in Cleveland and thinking, some point in my life, I want to be in California. You look at that and you go, you know what? This thing is designed for downforce tracks.
Well, that's exactly what I just said. Big tracks, same thing. Big track, downforce track, same thing. Does it have any kind of chill mode? How are the mannerisms when you get stuck on the 405 and it's 100 degrees? Is it all right?
Yeah, I mean, the car has AC and it's been well designed, you know, to cool down the cabin. But you know, it's an extreme car. You know, not for a second am I going to tell you this is like the car that you want to be sitting in traffic. I mean, the car itself will. You know, when you park it, it'll turn into a transformer and crush you. You know, it'll be so pissed off.
I got you.
And sitting in traffic and not being driven, right? What are you doing to me?
I feel you. That's okay. That's totally all right. I mean, not every, you know, I think there's something to be said for a car like that. And I think that the standard issue off the rack supercars in the $200,000 to $400,000 range, they're all extremely nice and the performance is extraordinary, but they're very easy. They're not, it's almost not an occasion. You know, when we get them to test, we just use them as everyday cars and people buy these things and then they stick them away. And it's almost a shame because the company's gone so far out of their way to make that thing usable to go to the grocery store. And, you know, people are afraid to put miles on it. And so if you're going to have a special car, you know, make it give you a special experience, you know?
Well, I mean, this is a very particular car. I mean, there are 80 cars that are going to be made. 80 of the 21C.
Okay.
It, right?
How many have you made so far?
Pardon?
Have you built it?
I mean, I mean, the two cars that are, I mean, we've done a bunch of work that led up to this, but I mean, the right now we built the first two cars, and the one car is, you know, right before we were about to ship to Geneva, we were going to ship both cars.
Oh yeah.
You know, we've been through a couple of months of, you know, of track driving to sort the car out. And, you know, then we're coming back and going into production. So we have to, you know, those were really the first track and first road car models that were built before we're going into production.
The image,
I mean,
that,
you know, our business itself is, obviously we have a, you know, a different, much larger business where we work for, you know, two of the top five global OEMs doing structures manufacturing that we can't say anything about, but, you know, this technology is going to be applied to mass production.
I'm sure it will be. I'm curious, just the photo that Zach had pulled up there, the blue car.
That's the track car.
Right. Are the doors open? Is that how the doors? Oh, so does the track car not have windows?
Pardon?
Does the track car have windows? Are the windows in the door?
The windows are down. The windows.
Oh, all right. Sorry. I'm looking at a photo from like far away, and the doors they're funky. They're butterfly style doors. But it just, from the angle I'm looking at, it almost doesn't look like a door could go, or a window could go in that door, but obviously it doesn't.
Oh, it's in. It's absolutely in there.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
All right. The doors are crazy long.
The door looks crazy long.
You've got electric windows. They go up and down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the door has to open to let both people out, kind of. You know, it's one door.
It's one door for a front
people.
And a back seat.
So the door is crazy long.
Oh, yeah. How many different iterations of door design did you go through, Kevin?
You know, we actually got that right pretty quickly, but it is a very cool door, and to make it super lightweight, you know, you had to do a lot of optimization and design and 3D printing. I mean, the cool thing about this car is that you really were able to unleash your imagination, and things that, you know, normally you'd look and go, oh, we're going to have to design something a little bit differently because of the way that you need to manufacture it. That didn't happen with any part of this car. I mean, we looked, and, you know, being able to, you know, do full digital generation and printing and assembly of a structure just changes it. Changes everything, right? It completely unleashes human freedom to create.
Two questions. One, where do the rear passengers' feet go, around or underneath the driver?
They go to the side. Drive.
Okay. Question number two: what parts in building a car can you just not make using your methods? Is it the interior? Is it what requires input from somewhere else, or a human, or something?
I'd say here, the gearbox casing you can print today, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you can't, you can't print gears out of hardened steel, you know, and, you know, put them through machining and everything else that you need to do right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, things like internal combustion heads. Yeah, absolutely. You can do now. So
is your combustion engine built using more traditional? I mean, it sounds like an extraordinary engine, but is it built using more traditional internal combustion technology?
I mean, it's our design, and it has a bunch of 3D printed parts, but obviously, like things like pistons and crankshaft and the internals to the engine, are traditionally manufactured.
Okay, cool. That sounds awesome, man.
Yeah. It's just
really
the other cool thing that
forms.
We do with it, I don't know if you've ever heard of this, Matt. It's kind of a cool thing. There are a bunch of companies around the world that are taking renewables, and instead of using them to store them in a battery for transportation, there's a way that, and it was actually invented here at USC. Now it's being used in a company Bill Gates has called Carbon Engineering, And then another company called Carbon Recycling International in Europe, which is where I actually buy my fuel. But what they're doing is they're taking renewables and they're using them to combine CO2 out of the atmosphere with hydrogen. And so instead of storing, say, sun or wind or nuclear or hydro in a battery, they turn it into a liquid. It's methanol, right? Which is obviously racing fuel. So literally, when I run the car track, when I do it, you know, and I run it at the track, I use this liquid that's called Vulcanol. It's just racing methanol, but generated completely renewably.
Interesting.
And so that car, as it's run, even though it has an internal combustion engine, it is a true zero emission vehicle.
When you burn that fuel, is the fuel a zero emission fuel because of its origin, or is it just it is, really?
It is, because what they're doing
is— How does that work?
I'll tell you what, go and look up Carbon Recycling International on Wikipedia.
Okay.
Right? And it'll take you like 2 minutes to read it.
Okay.
But what they're doing is they're using a desiccant. They're using an absorbent to absorb CO2 out of the atmosphere, but at an industrial scale. And then they're simply combining it. It's a relatively straightforward chemical reaction. They're combining it with hydrogen, and then you get the liquid. Because you're taking the CO2 out of the atmosphere, you're not adding any CO2 to the atmosphere.
Oh, that makes sense. Right, Yeah.
You know how, say, they always go, hey, you know, the perfect example of a sustainable ecosystem is, a wildflower meadow, because it's taking these different chemicals and elements, nitrogen and phosphorus and CO2, oxygen, hydrogen, and it's cycling them through the system. That's exactly what this is doing.
Yeah. You know, I didn't think about the fact that you're pulling the CO2 from the air, and therefore when you put it back into the air at the other end of the car, it was already there.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what the cool thing about it is. Every single one of these gas pumps that we have in America could pump this stuff out if we wanted to do it. Every single one of our cars could easily. It's just like a flex fuel. Right?
Really?
It's methanol.
How fast?
Methanol doesn't matter.
How fast can we make this shit? can we just start cranking it? I mean, hydrogen's very abundant, right?
If you ask me, it would be the single most important thing to do from a sustainability standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, with minimal modification, a regular internal combustion car can run on it, right?
Yeah, and it was invented by a Nobel Prize winning chemist, here at USC.
Yeah, this sounds like the kind of thing that, like, Mobil will buy them out and shut them down or something. You know what I mean? Exxon Mobil wants no part of this.
You would bet on that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, and so it's got to be like 116 octane equivalent, right? It's pretty high octane stuff.
Yeah, or more. I mean, if you just look at it at a NOC basis, I mean, it's, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, this is pure, I mean, it's racing fuel. It's methanol, right? It's racing alcohol. It's CH3OH, racing alcohol.
Is it expensive?
You know, I think we're paying like $8-$9 a gallon. But the thing is,
that's cheap for scale.
It's not at scale. Mm. If you look at methanol itself, that's produced by natural gas, it's like 50 cents a gallon right now, right?
Yeah.
So if we wanted to scale it up, all we'd need to do is, you know, mix part natural gas based methanol, because obviously we're producing a heck of a lot of natural gas in the U.S. We're actually flaring most of it, just burning it off and wasting it. You can convert that to methanol, mix it with sustainable methanol, and then just keep increasing as you scale up. You know, it brings the price down, and you just have more and more of the sustainable methanol mixed with the nat gas based methanol.
Oh, that's super interesting.
Look, there's actually that guy George Ola on Wikipedia. It's called The Methanol Economy.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, it obviously would, you know, would be a super big real threat to, you know, to the oil and gas companies and to EVs.
Right? Yeah.
But there it is. There you go.
I noticed that you, I mean, other than in the littlest bit that you need to contribute to the performance of the 21C, you're not really... you're not going for an EV at this time. It's like it would be the hot thing to do right now. But do you just, what kept you from doing a pure EV? Just wanting a Formula One car?
I mean, there was no reason to do it for it, you know, a car that you wanted to have as an ultimate performance car, right? I mean, you,
unless you're racing Pikes Peak, yes.
I mean, let's be real on physics and let's be technology agnostic. You know, some people are like, I'm an EV person, or, you know, I'm a this person. I'm a no technology agnostic person. I mean, I could care less what the technology is. I look at the result.
Okay.
Right?
That's a fair position.
And so I look and go, hey, can you with, you know, the thermal, you know, characteristics of a, you know, of a large EV car, you know, what size battery system, how heavy, how much does it consume resources? How long is this thing going to last on a track driving it hard? And if I can have a zero emission car on the track that's much lighter and faster and cooler, why would I want to be sitting on top of a huge, you know, king size mattress format battery pack driving around a track?
I mean, I don't think you personally would, but I could see why you, smart businessman, might want to market the technology that you're the rest of your technology as being associated with something that you don't have to explain to people why it's clean. You know what I mean?
You know what I think the coolest thing is? To say, you know what? I see this car here? It's got renewables stored in it. It's got renewables stored in a liquid. It's got liquid sunshine, liquid wind, liquid thermal. And you know what? It's a liquid that has 30 times the energy density of a battery. And I don't have to cart it around.
Yeah.
Why don't I just put that old liquid sunshine in my tank?
I think you are making a really good point. I think you're making a really good point about it. Yeah. Okay.
And I guess I'm kind of like, grew up in Cleveland, scruffy working class person who, you know, luckily was an All-American football player. So got, you know, found my way to college. And, I'm at the point where, you know, I don't care about technologies. I don't care about what's in. I care about what works. And I see a brand here. And the brand for Zinger and 21C is iconic design, which I think we have a super cool design. When people see this thing in reality, they just go, wow. And we're going to keep that design language on everything we do, right? It's built using a revolutionary technology, everything from materials to what prints it, to what assembles it, to the adhesives it uses, to all of the designs come from us, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we created the tools to create our dream machine. It has dominating performance. You look at those specs, you get this thing on the track, you know it. And it's built using a sustainable system, because the single biggest issue is not tailpipe exhaust. When you look, you're doing extractive mining of a bunch of different materials, you're processing them, you're manufacturing it. And then if you manufacture something that's hugely material and energy consumptive, very heavy, then you have to manufacture fuel for it, whether it's electricity or something else. Then you have to dispose of it. We're looking at it and saying, with a full real digital production system, just like nature, you know, nature, you look at a leaf or other things, it's only taking a material it chooses and putting it exactly where it's needed. It's the most super material and energy efficient system imaginable. Evolution, right? We use high performance computing and other technologies to do the same thing, but to expand man's creativity in doing it, while at the same time creating that material and energy efficiency. That's what's green. That's what's sustainable. And if you're looking at doing something, you want it small, light. Having a, you know, 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 pound vehicle that has a big battery you know, I'm sorry, you know, you can't create something sustainable that massively increases per vehicle the amount of material and energy used to produce it. You know, material that the makes up the vehicle itself, then all of the supporting infrastructure that's needed, plus all of the energy that needs to be produced, you know, manufactured to operate it.
Yeah, we live in LA and EVs are popular here, and I think sure. Part of that in LA has to do with the experience of driving them, but also, you know, people are conscious of smog and stuff here, and so the yep. tailpipe emissions are associated with local air quality. It's not, I think that because I just built a building and I was dealing with power companies and stuff like that, I think it would be virtually impossible for the city to provide enough power for, you know, a huge percentage of people to be driving EVs full time. Do you agree with that?
Well, what I'd say, Matt, is if you're going to do something like a Green New Deal, I mean, getting real serious for a moment.
Yeah.
You'd have to look at what are the inputs, meaning, you know, how many new mines do you need for nickel, cobalt, lithium, etc.? What's the infrastructure? What do you need to do that? How much power is needed? And then go, okay, if you get what you want, what does it actually look like? What has it done to the planet? And I think people would be absolutely shocked, because they would see, you know, you're opening up many, many, many new mines, which in and of themselves, we're in one planet, right? This is like spaceship, planet Earth, right? You know, we've got one atmosphere. You may not feel something somewhere, but you're going to feel it sooner or later if it coming from somewhere else, right?
Yeah.
So, you look at this, and the scale of all of these different things need to be really looked at and analyzed. It's called life cycle analysis, meaning, you know, look at things from extracting something to processing it, to manufacturing and manufacturing fuel, operating it, and then disposing. In that analysis, you have to also, just as you said, look at all of the infrastructure. How much power is needed? How many more new power stations? What are you replacing? What happens to it? What's the material and energy intensity? Because the single most important thing is the consumption of material and energy. That's the single most important factor in sustainability, not tailpipe exhaust. And we better look at that up front and actually do our homework. And we're not. And you know why? Because we're not tech agnostic and we're not brand agnostic. You know, we all have the things that we love and want to bet on. And instead of thinking clearly, you know, we let people take us for a ride.
I agree with you. I actually, you know, I've been making the, I'm not really a science person, but I feel like I have a sense of a bigger picture. And I've said that the cleanest thing you could do as the consumer of cars would be to buy a lightly used and well cared for relatively clean car, not some giant truck, and keep a car that's already here as clean as it can be and on the road for as long as it can be. Because making another car to replace it and disposing of this one is dirtier than just keeping this one going, unless it's like a horribly dirty car. Is there some truth in that, you think?
You're absolutely correct. 100% correct. I don't know. Do you know what Goldman Sachs is? You must, right? It's an investment bank.
Yes.
So Goldman Sachs in December of 2019, December 5th, 2019, put out a research report, right? And the research report was called New Era in CO2 Regulation, EVs to be Tested Across Life Cycle, Not Only on Running Performance,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
And you know why? Because, and it may be to like, you know, the, you know, sort of billionaire green tech set, you know, probably has their hair standing on end. But what this basically says is, unless you've got like a very small light EV that has about 150 mile range, once you get above that, it's no better than the average internal combustion engine vehicle being operated in the EU, in the European community. And, you know, when you look at what that vehicle is, right, it's like a 60 kilowatt hour vehicle that breaks even with the average internal combustion engine car, right? The average, not with a hybrid, with the average, complete average, right?
And the average is probably like a crossover with a V6.
You know what car companies are putting out?
Yeah, like 100.
200 kilowatt hour.
Who's got a 200?
You know what that's like? That's like you're driving three internal combustion engine vehicles at the same time.
Who's got a 200? I haven't heard of a 200 kilowatt hour. Who's got that?
It's called the Cadillac Escalade.
Oh.
2021. And you know what? And you know, I don't know what's Rivian have. I think their low end model is 150 kilowatt hour.
2021 Cadillac Escalade. Oh my God, a 400 mile range EV Escalade. Jesus.
Oh, there it says 200 kilowatt hour.
Yeah. I missed this story when it came out. Yeah, you're right. Can I just state for the record that my father has a 2017 Cadillac Escalade, and it could not be a bigger piece of shit if they made it that way intentionally. It is one of the most terrible things, and everybody involved in making it should be absolutely ashamed of themselves. It's junk. And it was, and the sticker on it was $97,000 for what is underneath a Silverado.
I'm staying out of that. And I love all car companies.
Bro, he bought it. There was no gratis. He bought it. Fuck it. That thing was a piece of shit. And there was 30K on the hood. 97 sticker out the door for 67 cash. It couldn't be a bigger piece of shit.
You know, but I mean, if you just look at that, right?
No, 200 kilowatt hours. That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, and so, you know, of course, we're ahead of everybody else in the world. You know, we of course are running away. You know, everybody that's into the new Green Deal is running away from life cycle analysis, right? Huh. Because you know they don't want the bad answer that
right.
You know, you can't supersize everything.
Yeah.
And great, very good. Expect that it's going to be sustainable, right?
Yeah.
How could that possibly be? No, I want bigger, 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 heavier, 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 you know, more power, more power, more power, and it's all going to be clean and free. Like, no.
That's not how that works. Holy shit, what is that electric Escalade going to weigh? 8,000 pounds?
Who knows, but that's literally like driving three of the average fleet average internal combustion engine vehicles in the EU, right?
That's like, crazy.
Hey, save the world, you know, triple the number of, you know, car equivalents you're driving per day.
I'm going to keep buying old cars. Kevin, we've got one question, I believe, from a fan that is directed directly at you. We got a few more questions that are just general car advice, and we won't torture Kevin with that, but we're going to give him the... What do you got there, Zach, for Kevin?
Let's see. Except Nuns asked, Kevin, what were the best and worst aspects of Coda, and how do the business models of your current ventures compare to your prior outings?
Well, I'd say the, you know, with Coda, you know, there, and this was a time before I was really, you know, fully aware of life cycle analysis. So that was a company that I co-founded, you know, in 2006, 2007, and was the CEO of. And, you know, at that time I was looking and saying, you know, here are these big problems of energy security and, an environmental impact of vehicles. You know, also the battery company was related to this, to Coda as a joint venture. And so I was looking at how to fix that. So the idea of putting together a team that had a very focused mission that could get everyone to work hard and be very enthused about. I think that was the best part of that. It also, you know, for my company today, you know, totally invaluable learning opportunity, because, you know, I set up a factory to do the tooling and conversion of that vehicle from an internal combustion to a full battery electric vehicle. And, you know, all of the economics of tooling, all of the economics of setting up stamping and body assembly line, you know, I learned and taught me
not to do that ever again. Wrong.
And I'll tell you, in 2009, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences came out with a life cycle analysis of electric vehicles that had exactly the opposite conclusion that I had thought it would, and I was shocked. And I remember standing in front of this million square foot battery manufacturing facility. And if you put into YouTube Gary Locke, who was the Secretary of Commerce at the time, and myself and Cody, you'll see we're standing in Tianjin in China with one of the members of the Chinese Politburo and the mayor of Tianjin in the world's first, you know, long before there was a gigafactory, right? This was the world's first battery mega factory. And I'm standing there in 2010. And I'm standing there thinking, you know what? I was so looking forward to this. I thought this was going to be the change the world moment. And you know what? When I've really looked at this life cycle analysis model, it tells me I have to, number one, rethink things and not be afraid, not be a coward, have the courage to rethink things. And that I can never allow myself to be too tied emotionally to any technology or any brand.
That's a good lesson. That's a good lesson. I like that lesson.
And so those are the lessons that I took away from that.
Yeah. All right. That's excellent. Kevin, I would like to come visit you at work.
Cool place. I would love it too. We'll have some fun.
Yeah. I got to see everything you guys are doing down there, and I need to hear what that engine sounds like.
You need to pick up the control arms that are printed. Are they printed titanium, Kevin, or are they printed Inconel?
I mean, they're either, if it's a control arm, it's either an aluminum that we call Alloy 52, which is our own patented aluminum, or it's titanium. But
dude, they're so light.
It was an aluminum one that's about 0.8 kilograms.
It doesn't make sense.
Well, that's crazy.
It's like picking up your house key.
Yeah,
and then
awesome.
But it's, you know, as long as this, like, camera stand, it's really nuts.
That's like the opposite of the shit at my building. I'm building a building, Kevin, and I have we're using number 18 rebar, which is an inch and a half thick, and I give a piece of it to people to show. They always almost drop it on their feet because it's so fucking heavy.
So I'll just give you this very short thing on the front upper control arm.
Yeah.
The tech saw, right?
Yeah.
So you look at that thing, right, and you're cutting, you know, 50% or more of the weight out of something in the normal way that you'd manufacture it, which is huge, right? I mean, you're talking about suspension and chassis structure, and you're taking out 20, 30, 50% of the weight, and you're increasing the performance. The other thing is, with our manufacturing system, you have the inputs, the hard points and keep out zones. Ordinarily, it would take, engineers, you know, weeks to design something, get a sign off on it, then have tooling or casting that's set up to manufacture it, and then you'd manufacture it, and who knows, that would be six to 12 months out from the start, right?
Mm-hmm.
We put it into our machine, 10 hours later you have a ready to print structure generated, you send it to the machine, and within 24 hours from the start you have that front upper control arm. And you put it on, real actuator-based test rig, and you run it through 150,000 kilometers, accelerated testing over a couple days. Boom, that's the cycle.
That's pretty awesome. That sounds great. I got to come see all that. That sounds awesome. And you're in California, in Los Angeles.
Torrance.
Right here. That's fantastic. What? Where can everyone find you? Is it, what's the website, Zach? Is it Zinger Vehicle?
Just Zinger. Zinger.com.
Zinger.com. CZINGER.com. And then also look up Divergent 3D, which is the 3D printing company, and it's badass.
It's very cool. And someone asked if you guys were hiring, so I directed them to your careers link, which is just HR at Zinger.com.
Yeah.
Yeah. There it is.
Thank you for your time, Kevin. We're gonna send you off, so you're not gonna have to get stuck answering what sports car you should buy for $20,000, like we're gonna be doing for the next half hour. But I would love to come visit you in Torrance, and I hope you and your family stay safe, and we will see you very soon. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, keep safe. Hey, good talking to you, Matt.
All right,
thanks, Kevin.
Bye. All right, Kevin Zinger. That is very, very cool stuff, man. That's bitchin'.
It's really, really cool. Like, it's just the way that they can create basically any shape. Like, they need to connect two points, right?
Yeah.
You need to connect a wheel hub to something.
Yeah.
How do you need to do that? So instead of having to, like, you know, okay, we have tooling built for an A-arm that we've been building for 2 to 10 years.
Yeah.
So if you're a huge company, like, you have to use that tooling because you've paid for it. Like, building cars is hard and expensive.
You're never committed to a piece of tooling ever. Right. That's pretty gangster. It's
pretty cool.
When Kevin was talking about the engine, Zach looked over at me and mouthed, "It's fucking crazy."
It is crazy. I mean,
you've seen it in person. I haven't.
I've seen it in person.
Did you hear it run?
No. Okay. They were finishing the touches on the two, on the white and the blue car for Geneva, and then Geneva got canceled because of everything, which is a bummer.
Yeah.
So, but it, I mean, it's really cool looking. I don't know what else to say.
But the videos on their website are real cars being driven. That's not CG, right?
No. They have a real car
being driven.
I think, like, development car. Okay. And they drove it on the street and they took it to Laguna. And, you know, that's kind of what I know about it.
That's
but,
sick. I got to fucking have a go in that. That looks incredible.
Can you imagine putting someone in the back and you're like, all right, and it's got to be such a different experience sitting behind someone going fast because you can't see
as
much.
Did they put a screen in the back of the seat so you could see around the driver in the front? That'd be cool. If you had a camera.
I don't think they did, but that's a good
gangster,
idea.
Gangster, wouldn't it?
That's a really good idea.
Yeah.
Because they have screens
for the mirror, for the rear view mirrors and, like, stuff. I saw the big tablet on the side. It's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to get some more of that. I have never heard of the no emissions methanol from the carbon in the air. It's completely neutral. That's crazy. I've never heard of that before.
Me neither.
That's awesome. Yeah. I'd so much rather that than EVs. No emissions gasoline? Are you fucking kidding me?
No, I know. There's always someone commented, they were like, well, methanol is, like, really corrosive and you need a lot more of it per mile. But, like, I like that people are thinking outside the two boxes that we have, which is like, well, we've been burning this fuel for 100 and whatever years.
Yeah.
And then the other option is electricity, which technically started in, like, the 1890s for cars. So if there's a different way to do it, plus if you're pulling, it seems too good to be true. I hope it's not, because you're pulling things out of the atmosphere that are greenhouse gases.
Yeah.
Which is sick.
Well, you're pulling, you know, you pull them out and you put them back in later. I mean, it's the same. That's pretty awesome.
I don't know. There's a bunch of stuff with carbon capture and all these things being developed. Like,
cool.
I don't know. The next 80 years is going to be very interesting.
Yeah, if we live that long.
Right.
let's go to the people.
Go to the people.
While you're going to the people, I'm getting another water.
All right. All right. Cool Dude 69. That's an amazing name.
Is 11. Happy 11th birthday.
How was the bowling alley for your birthday party? That is great. Or this is an old name from the AIM days.
Right.
Instant Messenger chat. He's planning on taking a road trip from San Diego to Omaha. He has two cars and he doesn't know which one to take. He's got a 2016 Focus RS with PS4s.
Nope.
Or he's got a 2000 Land Cruiser with KO2s. God.
Jesus Christ. These are definitely the Focus. Terrible options.
The Focus.
That's, Focus.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Because the Land Cruiser would be interesting only if you off-roaded from, like, San Diego to Vegas. Like, you could probably
do that. A Land Cruiser would be fantastic if it was brand new. It's an 18-year-old Land Cruiser. It's probably not as comfortable for that kind of road trip.
True. And then after you get out, when you're not off-roading, all you're doing is highway miles.
Yeah.
And, man, the drive to Nebraska from Colorado, I'll tell you what, It's just like driving on an endless runway.
I know.
It's no good.
It's not great in a Focus RS either, I'll be honest.
But no, but it'll be comfortable and fast.
I did 1,000 miles last year in the Lexus version of the Land Cruiser, and it was fucking nice.
I mean, yeah.
And it was brand new.
Right.
No, that being... No.
All right. Never Wander said he has a daily driver now, and he wants something rear-wheel drive for autocross and occasional track days. He's looking at MX-5. He's got about $20,000 budget. Mm-hmm. He's debating on an ND1 before the engine update and with a turbo, or stretch the money for a used ND2.
I would have a problem advising somebody to put a turbo on a Miata, on a new one like that, because I don't know if that's like a proven system or not.
I think Flying Miata does it with lots of success.
If they do it, then I would probably trust that. But autocross, you don't want a turbo for autocross.
True.
You want the better response of the newer engine for autocross.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You could also look at like a S2000s. Used SS1LE.
Yes, you could. Or an S2000 or any manner of 86s with a Rotrex supercharger.
Those are so cheap now.
20K gets you into a Corvette. I mean, it gets you into a C6.
I think you do that. I really do.
Yeah.
Because it feels, that has all the things
most
you
car.
Need. Most car.
It's the most car.
It's got
car.
All the torque for autocross, and it'll be more fun on a track eventually.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. If you got 20K, you know, a C6 Corvette is going to be a reliable $20,000 sports car that you can work with from there.
True.
But you're starting at a higher level.
The Miata will have cheaper consumables, which is good. But I would go
Corvette tires
ND
are expensive.
Yeah. Yeah. Just go the bigger engine. You don't want it.
Yeah. Corvette tires are pricey.
Dominic Boyer just asked if we'll do a future episode with Hurt. And I mean, the answer is of course. Like,
yeah, I haven't talked to that dude in a while, but yeah, sure. I gotta hit him up. Yeah. I feel weird because I every time I see him, it's nice. We hang out. He's fucking chill as hell. I don't like follow what the Hoonigan guys are like doing all the time.
They're doing everything.
I know
destroying
they're doing
tires.
Like everything all the time, yeah. But like I feel weird because I don't like follow their content.
He just built an A86 that he put a fucking 240 engine in with a turbo or something crazy like that. I don't know. But
Wouldn't it be a rotary? Isn't he committed to rotaries?
He is, but not in this case. I think he just wanted it to be done quickly.
An 86 would be very cool. They're fucking fun as hell. The old one.
Yeah.
They're
fun.
Rad. Yeah. Impossible to find a decent one.
Yeah. He refurbed it a lot.
Yeah.
Like he did a lot of paint work and stuff. And it looks really sick.
Yeah.
Hunter Haley asked, are you excited for adventure drives through the Northwest? I entered and I hope I win the Omaze contest.
Yeah, the Omaze contest, the entries got extended. It originally was going to end April 24th. They extended it to, I want to say, June 4th. So don't go all batshit about how it's a fucking scam. It's not a scam. Every time we do an Omaze ad, somebody has to comment that it's a scam. I looked into this because it sounded like a scam to me. It's not. Do you know how hard it is to get legal authority to run sweepstakes in not just all 50 states, but internationally? That shit has to be above board, dude. Sweepstakes are no joke. Mm-hmm. Giveaways like that with like six-figure cars and shit, that is so, that's legit. That's a legitimate business enterprise.
There's a movie called Quiz Show.
Yes.
From like the 30s. I mean, no, 50s. The movie was made in like the 90s, but
yes,
it was
John
based,
Turturro and Ralph Fiennes and shit.
And it was all about a quiz show, game show on TV that was actually rigged.
Yeah.
And I think because of that instance, there was a lawsuit and now there's laws around sweepstakes and they're very strict.
They're extremely strict. And I think some people who say that it's a quote scam, they say, well, it's for, you know, charity, but only like, you know, 15% of the total take goes to the charity. It's like, yeah, that's how like a lot of charities work. They have to buy the prizes. You know what I mean? They pay taxes on it. It is what it is. Anyway, I forgot how we got there. Adventure drives. Right. I am very excited. I hope it happens. It could go either way. I got the email this morning, actually. There was an update. That is, right now it is a go. There are a couple things that could cause it to be a no-go. Like, for instance, the border to Canada is closed right now, which is a problem. There were a couple things that were deal breakers, such as the border to Canada or hotels not being able to be open and accommodate us, That was, those two were deal breakers, and there was some other stuff that was like not necessarily deal breakers, like certain restaurants would be closed, or, you know, extreme social distancing or whatever. Like, it's pretty much like a road trip, people in their separate cars, people in their separate hotel rooms. Like, we're really gonna try to make it happen. The Safari Rally, unfortunately, it wasn't canceled, it was postponed indefinitely, I guess. We're fucking going. They kept my deposit. We're going when it happens. I said unless it's in during adventure drives, which I don't think, if they're going to postpone it, it'll probably be further. But it'll be super awesome if it happens, and it'll be rain checked and postponed if it doesn't. I'm sure. I mean, everyone who's doing adventure drives like wants to fucking go.
So. Yeah, the trip looked amazing.
Yeah, it's gonna be super sick. I don't know if they. I mean, I highly doubt anyone's going to sign up for a road trip in July now. But,
right.
But I don't know. Maybe Rob's making deals. I don't know. Hit him up. We'll
be
see
very,
what's up.
It'd be a little risky, a little presumptuous. But.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm excited. And if it happens, we're going to go. Yeah, yeah. I got my Beauty and the Beast mask. You see my mask?
Dude, your mask.
This is hilarious.
Does not.
So I got this mask, right? Sense. My brother-in-law and his wife, I don't necessarily, whatever their titles are. They have this coffee shop in Santa Monica called Bluey's. Shout out to Bluey's. And they're selling these masks. And they're like handmade masks, right?
Here, get a shot of the mask.
I mean, that's...
And from more than a couple of feet away, or even pretty close up, the mask looks like a stained glass window on a church. Which, I'm not religious in the least, but I just thought that was cool. And I bought the mask, and I've been wearing it around for... A day or two, and then someone came up to me and asked and said, oh, you don't look like a normal Beauty and the Beast fan. And I had absolutely no idea what they were talking about. And as it turns out, it's not a stained glass window, it's a still from Beauty and the Beast. And if you look in one of the windows of the thing, look, there's like there's Beauty like kissing the Beast.
Amazing. Right,
and it's so that's my coronavirus mask is Beauty and the Beast.
That's incredible. That's so, when you told me that, I looked closer, I was like, oh my god, that is Beauty and the Beast dancing and kissing. She's wearing a gown and everything.
Yep.
And amazing that someone spotted it. Yep. From several feet away, and they knew. They're like, yep. Oh, I have that.
Yep. As part of a stained glass window.
Well done.
All right.
Adam R. asks how Christian James Hand is doing.
I went to visit him.
Oh, you did?
I did. He had not left his apartment except for like a weekly grocery store run in like 8 weeks or however, since March, you know, 10th or whatever. And I was like, yo, if I go to Bay Cities and get Godmother's and ride my scooter over to Hollywood, would you have an 8 feet apart parking lot picnic with me and exit your apartment? And he said he would, and he did. And I went over there, and I rolled two mini joints, so we had a little separate joint, and then we had a little Godmother, and we had a little socially distant parking lot picnic, and it was actually quite nice.
Nice.
It was on the day that it was crazy hot. It was like 99 degrees in Hollywood,
dude.
And I rode my scooter. Riding home on the 101, it was 114 degrees. It's like riding into a hairdryer.
Yeah.
And I had not drank that much water.
Oh,
I got the sandwiches. Christian got us Mexican Cokes, which goes great with a Godmother. I hadn't had a fucking sugary soda in months. Months. And I was like, oh, this is good. But I really hadn't had any water. And I'm on the 101 into this hot wind. And I started feeling fucking lightheaded as hell. And I got over the hill and the temperature came back down again, it was fine. But for like 10 minutes, I was like inside my helmet. It was
bad.
Oh,
damn. Yeah. That's hot. Like, you might have to stop and just get water.
And then you'd
cool
open
off.
You'd open the vibe and it got worse.
Yeah, it doesn't help. It doesn't help at all. The breath coming out of your mouth is colder than what's going in and past you. Dude, that's so brutal.
It was brutal. But it's a nice time to be riding scooter around selfishly. And Christian is doing fine.
Wow. All right. Isaac Avocado asked if we know anything about Elio Motors. We've talked about it before, the interesting three-wheeled car. Someone else said that it's vaporware. But
yeah,
remember,
I mean,
this?
I don't necessarily think it's vaporware in terms of the fact, in terms of the way that, I don't think that's the right word. I think it's not happening. I don't think you should give them money. I think they're trying to make it work. They had some kind of vehicle that could be driven. I mean, I've seen these things driving, a couple of them anyway. They built at least one or two of them. It's definitely not something you can buy. Don't give them any money. But that does, but vaporware is the wrong word. There's a physical car in that photo, and it is driving on a road. So, yeah. But no, don't. It's Chorchinsky or one of those Jalopnik guys has done multiple deep dives, and it's basically like, you're not going to get a car. So I wouldn't. No.
Like, you know, if you go to their investors page on their website, this was last updated June 30th of 2016.
Yeah.
I think that tells you something about, I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know, it looks like a fun
That's about
fun
the last time
idea,
I heard someone mention LEO Motors
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
So, all right.
Stranger danger. And the last question is, can you do a review of the Tracking TT01? It's a one, that doesn't make any sense, a 1 kilopound car with 220 horsepower?
A 1,000 pound car.
Oh yeah,
1 kilopound. One.
I said it right, but I'm a fucking moron.
A kilopound.
Wow. A kilopound.
It's a kilopound. I mean, I suppose
that is the metric. That is how we would move into the metric system.
Right, right. Forget ton. It's kilopound.
Listen, we're not doing no metric system. All right, we'll do a little bit of a gateway.
Kilopound.
We'll do a kilopound.
Yeah. I mean, anyone who buys drugs knows the metric system. It's fine. What is that thing called?
It's tracking.
What a that? Oh, Track King.
Track King, but spelled with...
It's spelled in one word?
Yeah, man. Look how he wrote it. It's spelled with one word with a lowercase
K. That looks a lot. Go back to the photos. This looks a lot like the EXR LV003 that was for sale. The EXR race series that they were selling the entire series. And you stick a different grill on these cars. And it was like a Renault engine... tube chassis car. It looks like this. I mean, this is a little silly race car. It's a little race car. I don't know anything about it. It has a very stupid name. And it looks like you can make it look like a sort of a DTM car. But it looks, look now, give me, get a picture of the...
Of the white one?
The EXR spec race car, which looks a lot... like that, which was based on a French car called a Midget. And it honestly looks like the same thing. Doesn't it look like almost the same thing?
Yeah, like, okay, so that's EXR.
The LV02, which is based on the French Midget.
It's like an A3 coupe kind of thing?
Well,
with a Z4 back?
Yeah, it's they put different headlight and taillight stickers and grill stickers
right.
on it. But it's just sort of a, you know, fairly generic DTM-esque coupe. This Tracker one, oh, wow, that Track King, that's a terrible photograph.
That is not a good photograph.
That's a really...
It's actually a low-res photograph, too.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. That's all we know about it.
The rear window is different. Like,
it's not the same. Seeing them side by side is not the same. But it looks like a similar kind of idea. Vaguely DTM-esque tube chassis car. This one, that looks pretty... Oh, center seat? It's like a little thing?
Kind of center
yeah,
seat?
Yeah, I don't know. I that's not for me.
You know what
this
looks like? It looks a little bit like a Legends car,
yeah,
but for an
with
adult.
A modern body on it, yeah.
Yeah, it's your kind of left seat. I mean, I bet it's fun.
I'd rather have a cross cart.
But, yeah. Oh, man.
Maybe a cross cart.
220 horsepower in this.
I mean, it's probably a good time. It's very unfortunate looking, though.
It is.
That's the best word you can use to describe it.
Fenders and whatnot do not look good.
Zach, who's coming in the rest of this week? Do I know? My phone. I forgot who I booked. I can't even remember who I booked on my own show.
Some guys at Lame Let's Go Joe said, asked if you've ever ridden a super motard because you said that the Morgan is a better drive home than a super moto.
I've ridden a super moto before. Yeah, I'm like a big fucking gorilla on a super moto. If they don't really make super motos my size, I they're cool. I totally get why you would. Is a Morgan better than a super moto? I mean, obviously you're talking about different things. The Morgan, you're a fancy person. No, women will not stop you on the street because you brapped your super moto. Women literally will stop you on the street if you're driving a Morgan. And there is not a lot better ways to start or end your day than being smiled and waved at by a pretty girl on the street.
True.
It's the only car I've been in ever since my DeLorean, but it's even better than the DeLorean. The Morgan is good at getting girls. It's shockingly good at that. Great. That's our show. Tomorrow, we've got Misha Mansoor from the band Periphery. Misha Mansoor is coming. I don't know if he might come in. Maybe. We'll see. Or he might Skype in. I don't know. Thursday, we've got Randy Nonnenberg from Bring a Trailer. And then that's this week. Yeah. So we got Misha tomorrow, the 12th, 5 p.m. Randy, Thursday, the 14th at 4 p.m. Bring a Trailer discussion is going to be very interesting. And Misha is he's a very talented musician and also a hardcore car person. He's really smart. He's
cool.
All right. Thanks, everybody. That's our show, the Smoking Tire Podcast, powered by Shout Engine. Get your own damn podcast at shoutengine.com. It's easy. All you need is a microphone and connection to the internet, and ideally something to say. Good night, folks.